Hey everyone, just before we get into this episode, just a quick announcement. We have some new stuff on our web shop. We've t-shirts, some cool posters, and some signed copies of Matt's book, Painted People. So it's beneaththeskinshop.com and the link is in the description of this episode. Anyway, back to the show.
Thanks for coming to my house yesterday, Thomas.
It was a wonderful time to spend a few hours trying to fix lights and completely messing up your office.
Yeah, making an absolute fucking mess of the place. That I still can't find everything that I was looking for.
I mean, you're as you said, you're not a hoarder. You were very quick to point that out.
I'm not a hoarder. I just have a lot of stuff, and I realized I probably have. The thing I bought most recently, because I thought I didn't have it, I found a copy of it that someone sent me about 5 years ago. So keep your eyes peeled on where can, you know, let's tease this. Where can our listeners engage with what we were working on yesterday?
Yes, so we are doing some video stuff. Check out the Patreon if you're on the Patreon. You're hearing this nice and early. We are doing some video stuff where Matt talks through some fun visual stuff from his collection, like books, weird cockamamies, and stuff in the future like flashbooks. And it's, you know, video series fun. You might see some clips of it on Instagram. But to get the full thing, check out the £5 tier on Patreon. Also, you're very welcome to Beneath the Skin, the show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. I'm one of your hosts, Thomas O'Mahony, and I'm joined, as ever, by my esteemed co-host, Dr. Matt Lauder.
Hello, darlings.
Yesterday I saw Matt. I left the room for maybe like 5 minutes and came back, and there was just like the bottom shelf was completely empty and just all of this stuff had been pulled out, and Matt was going through it like what to talk about. Saw some cool stuff, some of which will be up in the shop alongside our merch and posters and that sort of stuff. So keep your eyes peeled for some rare history.
Well, I'm not a collector, and I don't buy and sell stuff, but I did have a couple of dupes of some things maybe the best way to shift that is through our shop. So yeah, as I'm having a clear out, maybe a couple of things. As I said, just bits of paper, largely, magazines and books and stuff. So yeah, I also gave you some of my dupes because I found I had dupes of things. So yeah, I gave you some stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it was great fun taking it out of my bag today and just the room immediately smelling like 60-year-old smoke.
Yeah, that's the thing. All these bits of paper happen to suck up cigarette smoke. Mm. But anyway, yes.
So we are
speaking of 60 years ago.
Yeah, speaking of 60 years ago, we are continuing our mini series on the history of tattoo conventions. When we left you last time, we had talked about the Houston convention in 1976 as organized by Lyle Tuttle. This is kind of like a real inflection point of where tattoo conventions are going from their kind of proto form in Japan and are now being brought to the West, and this is kind of like really the point where they start to become a thing.
Yeah, and we've sort of hinted about this moment, and we hinted about it when we spoke to Paul in our still to be completed chat with him about the life of Rudy Inhelder, this next moment, which is the following year, in 1976. 77, in Reno, Nevada, is like, well, Ed Hardy himself like called it the first time we got a look at the new tattoo, right? So Ed himself kind of claims this moment at Reno as Yeah, as like the first time that really kind of what we think of as the modern tattoo industry really came together. Lyle's convention the year before has been in Houston, is really the first proper international tattoo convention in the modern sense, insofar as, you know, it's open to the public, et cetera, et cetera. But it was fairly small scale in comparison. And I think, you know, Reno does seem to be this second international convention does seem to be, yeah, as you said, this really inflection point that we'll get into. So it's worth maybe refreshing our memory about what's happening at this moment in time and why tattooers are putting on conventions anyway, right? And the key driver is increasing regulation through the late 60s and early 70s against tattooing, both in America and in Britain. So tattooing had been banned in New York in the early 1960s. Tattooing was banned for under 18s in England in 1969. I think we talked about that in the last episode. Tattooing was kind of getting a bit of a bad rep, I suppose, publicly as it was getting more popular. There's a sort of paradox happening, right? Where tattooing is getting more popular. Lyle Tuttle's tattooed Janis Joplin and is on the cover of Rolling Stone in the early 70s, and tattooing is becoming very popular. But that popularity is bringing with it increased heat and increased pressure from regulators.
Also worth noting as well, the Esquire piece that was done on American tattooing after
Houston.
Yeah, after Houston as well.
Yeah, so the Houston event attracted, as we mentioned last episode as well, attracted lots of press. Esquire magazine did a big shoot there. Parry Match, as we were talking about the other day, Tom, did a big international report on it. Chicago Tribune were there. So it was a big deal, that event. And it was designed basically to present a better image to the world of tattooing than this one of, you know, transmission of hepatitis and tattooing of underage kids, right? It wanted to, the industry, and particularly the International Tattoo Association, Tattoo Artists Association, which had been set up in the UK by Terry Wrigley, and the North American Tattoo Club, of which Lyle Tuttle was kind of the figurehead and Dave Yerk, who was involved, were basically kind of leading this, you know, leading this charge and basically trying to say, look, we want tattooing to be, you know, be legitimate. So one of the organizers of the Reno convention, this tattooer, Matthews from Reno, basically said to the Reno Evening Gazette in the run-up to Reno, quote, everyone used to look at tattooing like it was something done down in the slums where they sold chitlin sandwiches and women walked the streets. However, Matthews now tattoos people from all walks of life, including housewives, doctors, and lawyers. Tattooing not just for sailors anymore, before I was born.
For doctors, right, and lawyers.
So, exactly. The other thing that happened, so the Tattoo Club of America had, Rudy's version had disbanded. Spider Web had tried to restart it or start a new organization under the same name. He'd also had a big crusade in 1976 where he'd staged a performance. We'll do a whole episode about Spider Web, maybe as part of the show and tell videos, because I've got some interesting stuff we can talk about with him. But he tried in the New York State court in 1976 to claim that tattooing was an art form and therefore banning it was unconstitutional. He was unsuccessful. The lawyers for artists actually refused to represent him, saying that tattooing was not an art form in their eyes. The court in that case basically ruled that even if it was an art form, it was still okay to ban it, right? So tattooing's in this kind of weird place, as I said. The 76 convention in Houston had been a start, but it was decided really to sort of seize on this energy by doing an even bigger and even better thing in Reno. And Reno proved a location that was, I think, really crucially closer to California, for reasons that we we'll come to. So the convention, the Arena Convention, is put on by the ITAA, the International Tattoo Artists Association. It had been started in 1975 by Terry Wrigley, as I said, in the UK. Wrigley was like one of the most kind of, you know, highly rated tattooers in the world at the time. Lyle Tuttle had included him in his top 20 artists of the in the world list that he'd put out in 1970. And unlike the Tattoo Club of America in its various versions, unlike the Bristol Tattoo Club, the ITAA was an association for tattoo artists only. And it very, very quickly kind of developed membership really broadly, right? So Australians were members. So Cindy Ray was a member. John Entwistle was a member. Lots of members in Western Europe, including, as we'll come to, Tattoo Sammy Horst Streckenbach in Germany, and even members in Japan, right? So there's this big key kind of overlapping group. And as I said, this real worry that tattooing is under threat. In fact, in the ITA newsletter, which is a really interesting source for this period, in the run-up to the convention, they're talking like really explicitly about protecting themselves and their reputation for reasons that become important later on. So Wrigley says, quote, I think we mentioned this in the last episode, didn't we? The stuff about the Hang Gliding Association.
Yeah, we did.
We did mention that, but I'll read it out again. So the British Hang Gliding Association was formed last month. After hang gliding being popular in the UK for only 4 years, if an association hadn't been banned, hang gliding would have been banned. But because the newly formed association was formed and gave assurance it would police itself, hang gliding was allowed to stay. How we can do this effectively can only come about by discussion at the Reno Convention. Right. So another one of the sort of local organisers of Reno, a guy called Mike LaCuya, who tattooed in Reno, said, quote, we're trying to upgrade tattooing. And Dave Yerk, who is the president of the North American Tattoo Club, was also involved. The event was well attended. So George Bone was there. Tattoo Ole from Copenhagen was there. And there were over 1,000 members of the public. So it was massive.
Mm-hmm.
There was a huge amount of artists as well from the United States, including, importantly, Charlie Cartwright and Jack Rudy from East LA. And this was one of the real takeaways for Hardy at Reno, because he had never seen this kind of stuff before. Charlie and Jack had, along with Freddie Negrete, had been kind of beavering away in East LA doing this incredible Chicano inspired, LA prison inspired single needle black and gray work. And this was basically their presentation of it to the world. They'd heard about the Houston convention and not attended, but they decided to go to Nevada because it was nearby. Like Hardy was blown away, because if you can imagine, you know, what tattooing was looked like in the '70s, it was starting to change, and Hardy in particular had been responsible for that. But this was a really, really dramatically different way of tattooing. I mean, almost actually, as Cartwright and Rudy themselves describe, almost like a hearkening back to the Victorian period stuff, right? Like Burchett and MacDonald. There's a direct connection as far as Rudy's concerned. I mean, I don't know if you want to, what you think, like, you know, what you imagine that kind of seeing black and, I mean, it seems so funny because it's so ubiquitous, obviously. And, you know, those of us that are so now immersed in the Victorian tattooing, it doesn't come as a surprise. But I wonder if you can put yourselves in the shoes of someone who'd lived through the 40s, 50s and 60s and, you know, of American tattooing, and all of a sudden seen the stuff that Jack Rudy and Charlie Cartwright, Good Time Charlie, were doing out of that shop in the early '70s.
I mean, like, I always think of with stuff like this, when something like really truly new comes along, I always think of Ozzy Osbourne's quote about hearing the Beatles for the first time.
Right. What did he say?
His whole thing was that when he first heard the Beatles, it was like, you know, he went to sleep one night and the world was in, you know, black and white, and then he woke up and suddenly the world was in Technicolor.
So, okay, so it's the opposite way around for this, right?
Yeah, but like, same sentiment, you know.
Hardy woke up one day and all of a sudden the world was black and grey. Yeah, that's it. That's good, though. That's a really nice way of, way of putting it.
And like, yeah, like, but like, literally, when you think about it, like, without Reno, it's like the world doesn't get black and grey in the same way, you know?
No, I mean, because literally in the this is another future episode as well, but in the aftermath of this convention, like, Ed Hardy goes to LA and basically buys the shop. Like,
there you go. Right?
And, you know, it becomes Tattoo Land and is nurtured into the powerhouse that it becomes, right? So this, I mean, Malone, of course, is also alongside as one of the business brains here as well. But yeah, this is, as you said, this is the next piece in the puzzle, right? So in my new book, I go into this in more detail, but basically, you know, if you think there are kind of four basic styles of tattooing, right? There's American traditional tattooing, we might call it, you know, the kind of Western sailor style. There's quote unquote tribal, you know, black work. There's black and gray. There's orientalist, right? The kind of westernized versions of Japanese and other orientally styled tattoo, you know, that had been absorbed into something that was orientalist. And in this period, right, like, Hardy is revivifying American traditional by engaging with Sailor Jerry, by starting in the aftermath of this convention of Reno, publishing Tattoo Time and showing the world Burt Grimm and etc. He's obviously been to Japan and is again working with Horihide, like, because and bringing new styles of Japanese tattooing to America. He in the following decade is massively involved in the reinvention and spreading of black work, of quote unquote tribal tattooing. And he's also, you know, responsible in so many ways for kind of bringing the black and gray style out of the very local context that it had in East LA to the global scene. So there's like four styles of tattooing. And in this moment, literally in the sort of years running up and surrounding this convention, Hardy's involved in like rebirthing them and supporting and patronizing the people that were transforming all four of those styles. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I think as well, like, it bears saying that, you know, while Ed is kind of the conduit through which all this stuff flows, like, the people who are, you know, like, Charlie Cartwright, Jack Rudy, like, they are the people who were responsible for it. Ed is the node at which through it travels.
That's it. That's exactly right. And he is, you know, he's super excited. You can read this. You can read this in many times when he's spoken about the Reno Convention. And as I said, he is like utterly blown away by how exciting tattooing is in 1977, and how, you know, how it's kind of emerging from the shadows, but still maintaining this kind of power and authenticity and strangeness and visual, you know, heft, like, as it becomes quote unquote more mainstream, which, to be, you know, again, to repeat ourselves here, is the active strategy of people like Hardy and Tuttle and Yerku and others. They want to make tattooing mainstream because it makes their lives easier, right? And it means that tattooing as an art form can continue to develop and progress. But as tattooing becomes more and more quote unquote mainstream, it's developing and flourishing and becoming more exciting. And so, you know, I think, again, to hammer home the usual point, like, we talk so much about tattooing, you know, coming out of the shadows and stuff, but like, it was an active decision by those involved at the center of the industry because they loved it so much and wanted to evangelize of it. And of course, yeah, the generations before them as well, Skuse and, you know, even people before him who were so, you know, enamored by tattooing that they wanted to speak about it. But this kind of celebration of tattooing comes not as it's commodified or as it's watered down, but as it's celebrated and championed by, you know, the best tattoo artists of the Western tradition.
But I will say, maybe I think as well, not to discount the kind of the magical quality and the love that the, you know, the people involved had for it. It was also, you know, it was a business decision as well. Like, you know, Hardy, Rollo, Lyle, you know, Sailor Sammy is a little bit of a countercurrent to that, because he was like, you know, why do you want to have tattoo competitions? Like, this is art. Like, do you want a trophy? Do you want a medal? Fuck off. I want to be weird.
Yeah, we'll come to that though. We'll come to that, because that also, there's also some interesting tension there. So we'll come to that in a second for sure.
But yeah, it's like, I think it is this thing that I know we've talked about and I've talked about with other people, that like tattooing is only ever underground when you first get into it, plus like 2 or 3 years. And whenever you talk to people who've been, regardless of whatever amount of time they've been into tattooing, they will always think that tattooing was underground when they first got into it, rather than, yeah, it is a counterculture kind of like art form, it's rebellious, but it's also like the reason most people probably know about tattooing was business decisions that people made based off an art form they loved.
That's right. And we're hopefully going to get Alan Govanar on the show soon. We're in an email discussion with him, who's one of the kind of documenters, academic documenters, you know, of this period. He was very close to Hardy in this period. He's the guy that really sort of academically coined or sort of popularized this term tattoo renaissance for this period, because, you know, I've questioned that, because I think the idea of disappearance and reemergence is overstated, particularly when you focus on things other than the United States. But it is true that, like, if you do want to pick a moment where tattooing sort of changes in for the Western industry, this is it. But as you said, it's not coming out of nowhere, and it wasn't exactly this completely hidden thing. I mean, again, the reason the conventions happen and tattooing is because it's been getting so popular that for nearly a decade by this point, you know, that it's starting to receive backlash. So there's a kind of time lag here as well. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And of course, you know, these stories are always kind of multifaceted and complicated anyway. But yeah, so let's talk about Tattoo Sammy, actually, because he's a really important part of this story. He traveled from Germany to the first convention in Houston with his apprentice and friend Manfred Kors, who now runs the German Institute of Tattoo History, an amazing collector and documenter of European tattoo history. He was there, you know, they were there. Sammy's this amazing guy. Sammy was a kind of tinkerer, really creative problem-solving guy who is credited for inventing the body-piercing barbell, as well as being probably the first like really visible person to have a tongue piercing in the Western world. Really important piercing figure as well as for tattooing. And he also became, as you said, this kind of countervailing voice against the really kind of sort of self-congratulatory American scene. And this becomes part of the kind of schism that we'll come to and why Reno is so important. So a couple of years later, so the year after Reno, as we'll come to, was the convention in Amsterdam. And then the year after that was in Denver, Colorado. And Tattoo Sammy basically said, This is a little sort of flyer that he circulated called New Ways for Having Successful Conventions in the Future. So kind of like an open letter, basically, 79. Hello, friends. This is like kind of, you know, posting on Instagram in the days before Instagram with a big, like, you know.
Once again, you know, very, very true to his German ancestry. It's very Lutheran, it's, you know, nailing the theses on the door. Hey, are you enjoying the show? If you really like Beneath the Skin and you want to help support us, You can do so on Patreon. For little as £5 a month, you can help make this show possible, help us buy research materials. So if you like the show and you want to support us, consider kicking us a few quid a month, and you'll get everything from bonus episodes to Q&As, and you can even vote on what tattoo I'll get when we reach a certain subscriber count. Matt, have you got anything to say?
You should really definitely fund the Patreon, because tattoo history is massive, right? Deep, wide, complicated. We're covering some big hit topics on the main feed, but on the Patreon subscriber-only feed, we'll be getting into some really more interesting, niche, deep topics you don't want to miss out on. And honestly, the chance to kind of decide what Thomas gets on his body is probably just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Subscribe, chuck us a few quid. Don't miss out on the chance to ruin Thomas's body forever.
Hello, friends. This pamphlet with all the stirring up titles should be more than the old international outcry for help in the last minutes. It should give all artists and fans as well a reason to think about and discuss it free and fair. If you ask why I wrote this, I have a clear answer for you. Just take a critical look around and you will as sure as the tacks agree. It is not to be overlooked that you will miss a lot of our very well-known artists and representative persons who are VIPs on conventions held prior. Some other few are here just demonstrating there is still a small and faint hope for the future of associations and conventions as well. I'm just one of them, hoping to give a hand creating a big and strong brotherhood of skilled and experienced tattooers. Those who avoid coming to further conventions should be quoted as non-cooperative anyway, not excused as being too busy. If we ever want to get ahead, we should also try not to overturn ourselves, and we should let the seed sown by Dave Yerku in 1976 in Houston grow and ripen in a slow, natural way to full blossom and fruitful stage without going the awful way, distributing sensational and shocking news. All internal troubles in the different associations should be settled or straightened out by their representatives, avoiding all discussions with outsiders. And there's another problem. The trade secrets, as many coil handling, low volt DC wiring, and the addresses of some suppliers. It's hard to believe that at a time when every second tattoo artist who can spell mom and dad right is planning to write a book about his work, there are such a lot of others who are absolutely convinced that there is any possibility of keeping these secrets real tight. He also says, he goes on basically saying that the conventions in Houston, in Reno, and the torpedoed Amsterdam convention, which we'll come to, were, we could say, just meetings of tattooers and fans. All three of them failed to be advertised and respected art happenings. This is what we should have had in mind if we ever want to succeed with the conventions. It's a shame for the whole trade that the voted Tattoo Artists of the Years in 76 and 77 had no interest in coming to Amsterdam in 78. In my eyes, a very strange behaviour. Profit should not always come first for people who were honoured at a convention. It should be an act of self-discipline. So the first convention at Houston held many artists and fans and showed and displayed tattoos and piercings. And we'll talk about that as well in a second. And the piercings becomes really interesting. You can see there, right? Like, Sammy's like, tattoo conventions are cool. They're really exciting. But they're dick-waving competitions for artists who think that they're better than everyone else, who create this kind of clique, basically. And he says, there's still a ban about tattooing in all dictator-run countries. In other words, nobody there has a chance that we have to express his own will, ideas, feelings, appearances, or publications. So during the Cold War, right, as a guy in Germany, he wants to spread the love for tattooing. And he thinks that the people responsible for the two American conventions and the one in Amsterdam, which again, we'll talk about in more detail in a second, were just self-congratulatory, who were kind of using it as ways to kind of, you know, get one over on their enemies, who were kind of, you know, creating cliques, in groups, out groups, and he wanted it to be better.
I think it makes sense in terms of, you know, seeing all this like press coverage of, you know, Reno and Houston, and like a lot of it centering on a certain handful of people, and if you are kind of, I suppose, like an artist, if you're doing this for the art and not really caring about the business or making it mainstream, I can understand why he felt this way. It was like, you know, we're not having conventions to hand out awards of who's the best artist. We're doing it to see like who's out there, what we can do, and trying to push it forward in terms of the art rather than the business.
Yeah, and this has been a kind of hobby horse for him for a while. I mean, that was 79. The year before, he wrote a thing for the Amsterdam convention, although only in German. But he says there in the previous years, previous years kind of thing, flyer that he put out, we don't persuade anybody, we have to convince them. Right. So he was like, it's not good enough just to go, look, we're here and tattooing's great. Like, take it or leave it. If you're serious about, particularly, you know, in conservative countries like Europe, you know, like Germany at the time, you have to kind of articulate and be brave enough to speak for your whole industry and not try and kind of draw, arbitrary lines around who gets to be a representative of the industry and who doesn't, right?
Yeah. And I suppose we should talk about Amsterdam now.
Well, no, I think we need to finish off with what happened at Reno and why Sammy was so interested, because the big controversy and the real big gatekeeping moment that happened was around what happened at the closing event at Reno. So at the close, and again, if you've listened to our interview with Paul or the talk that he did, he's mentioned this in his talk, but basically Fakir Musafar, who was an engineer and artist, performer from South Dakota originally, basically used the Reno Convention as his opportunity to sort of come out as Fakir Musafar, as this modern primitive performer. Go listen to our talk with Paul's talk when he goes into more detail about that. But basically, Fakir did the closing show of the event, where he laid a bed of nails. He had a huge, you know, quote unquote tribal black work back piece done by Davy Jones. He basically monopolized a lot of the press coverage. So in advance of the convention and in the aftermath of it, it was photos of him and discussions of him that really kind of led the story. And also a lot of discussion about body piercing. Which, you know, Fakir was a big advocate and pioneer of, along with Jim Ward. And of course, Sammy was a big advocate for body piercing as well, and he knew Jim Ward. And basically what happened at the end of the convention, and this is where essentially Hardy comes back into the picture, right? In the aftermath of the event, as we know from the ITAA newsletter following the event, Dave Yerku wrote, quote, Ed Hardy asked to speak. Ed talked about piercing. He felt, as did the overwhelming majority of artists there, that it did not belong at a tattoo convention and should not be linked to tattooing. And Hardy in his own book writes, quote, piercing raised the sinister specter of S&M at a time when we were pushing to gain a little respectability for tattoos. Most of us pushing to expand the work didn't buy the argument that tattoo and piercing were on the same level. This is the coming out party for the new tattoo. And so for Hardy, who wasn't a piercing guy, he felt that this was distracting and it didn't tell the story that he wanted to. And of course, other members, although not Hardy himself, you know, were also concerned about the associations of piercing with the gay community. It's weird, though, because in the run-up to the Reno Convention, English tattooers and people like Lionel Titchener and others were talking about whether they should bring their piercing equipment, because they'd already begun making a living or an additional living, piercing ears in particular, you know, occasionally other things as well. But piercing was already part of the business. Yerku himself, apparently, according to Tattoo Sammy, was quite a big fan of piercing up until all of a sudden, you know, the cool kids said, no piercings at conventions. And then that was it. And that was one of the main things that really upset Sammy.
And I think the big concern, I suppose, when certain people were like trying to essentially make this kind of mainstream push, was that piercing and all that kind of goes with it, it scares away the normies. Like the normal people in society would see, you know, piercing people like Fakir and like the general, like the associations with like S&M and the gay community. And it would like, oh no, okay, yeah, no, these people are all weird.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's, and because the, you know, Hardy understood very well the kind of, you know, need for mainstream tolerance in order to kind of get the authorities off their back and to really, you know, make it so that tattooing, I mean, there were, tattooing was legal in New York and there were other bans in place or potentially going to be in place in other states around the US. And so, you know, I think in hindsight, again, I go into this in my new book, like it's interesting because Hardy and Fakir's 1980s diverge in a really interesting way, but by 1989, they're back in the same book, right? They're both in Modern Primitives. So, you know, I lay that out in more detail in the book and we'll probably talk about it again in future. But this is the real schism point, right? It's like, is tattooing for the weirdos, where if you're Tattoo Sammy, it's the industry's job to persuade polite society that weird being weird is okay. Or do you take the strategy where you say, we're not weird, we're actually very normal and please mm-hmm. leave us alone. Right.
Yeah.
And those are two divergent strategies coming both from actually a place of love. I think hindsight, as I said, probably proves that I think Fakir won that battle. Although again, the intellectual history and the kind of historiographical history of how those stories diverge over the 80s is for another episode. I don't know. What do you think? Like, who can you understand? Or, I mean, I was, you know, there is a sense really when you hear that story for the first time that like, oh my God, fuck Ed Hardy, like who was trying to kind of gatekeep. But, you know, having spent a long time thinking about this, I understand where he comes from. Although I have to say, I don't necessarily think it was the right decision.
Well, I think the thing is that, like, I don't think there's really a right side in this argument. Like, nobody is, like, 100% right. And I think it really falls down on where you place the value in tattooing. And, you know, I think tattooing as it exists is a wider kind of spectrum of body modification, behavior, and art forms. It's like, I think it can be viewed as a little bit as a kind of having your cake and eating it too moment. Is like, we are, you know, we're a little bit out there, we're weird, we're counterculture, we're rebellious, but please don't look at the weirdos in the corner. Like, they're too weird for us. It feels a small bit hypocritical, but
yeah, and it also speaks against that. I think, you know, it speaks for the idea that you were saying about how, you know, thinking about tattooing being underground or not, right? Like the whole strategy here by the International Tattoo Artists Association was to say, no, we're not underground, we're very nice, like the weirdos are the weirdos, like we're not edgy.
But right? The thing I would say on the other side as well is that, like, I can understand it because, like, they were under a genuine, like, material threat to their art form and their business of, like, it's already banned in New York, there's other bands on the table. It's like, this could go away if we don't do something. And obviously, hence the whole reasoning for tattoo conventions in the beginning, in the first place. So it's a case of, like, nobody's really right and nobody's really wrong. It's, you know, somewhere in between. And it really depends on what perspective you subscribe to and where you place your personal values in terms of either tattooing or piercing or a combination of the two, but also where... Yeah. You place your values in the intersection between art and commerciality as well.
Well, and also art and identity. And I think probably this is the actual break, right? Because Ed Hardy is perfectly aware that tattooing is a weird, dangerous, powerful, magical art form, but it's not. It is for him an artistic practice, a creative practice. For Fakir. And Sammy's actually somewhere in between this, I think, but certainly for Fakir, like, tattooing is part of an identity formation strategy. And so, you know, Hardy wants to advocate for tattooing, even though mainstream society thinks it's weird. Sammy and Fakir and the piercing guys and gals, you know, people like Elizabeth Weinzel was involved with this as well, that they have their own little crew. They're advocating for weirdness per se.
But I think, right,
as a lifestyle, as an identity practice.
But I think the the pure fact that Fakir and Ed appear together in Modern Primitives like a little over a decade later is just, I think it's proof that this moment in time, more so than some sort of like artistic and value based disagreement, is more so it's growing pains in the conceptualization of what does this stuff mean. And everyone, rather than having like a meaning that has coalesced over time, is like trying to put forth different definitions at the same time. And it's like, obviously, you know, you're going to have tendency infighting, and it's that split, while there is some still some legacy of it today, those growing pains were mostly overcome by the time you get to something like Modern Primitives.
Yeah, I think that's right, right? And I mean, and again, it's worth sort of thinking about the 78 convention in Amsterdam then, because all of that bad blood, really, in the aftermath of Reno is sort of bubbling under the surface. You know, Hardy doesn't go to Amsterdam, for example. Tattoo piercing is not actually banned. In fact, the two tattooers that win jointly Tattoo Artist of the Year at that convention, Tattoo Sammy himself and Cliff Raven, you know, Hardy's protege, to some degree, Cliff Raven, have pierced nipples, right? Raven is a gay man, and Sammy's, you know, around about that scene, although not gay himself. There's still a kind of toleration at this moment, but it is a bit edgy. And in fact, you know, Sammy himself says, here in Amsterdam, we want to offer everyone, whether a casual or conscious visitor, expert or media representative, colleague, label and critic, so many suggestions, comparative material in genuine representation or creativity, numerous possibilities for observation, criticism, publication. And there are colleagues who plan in a selfless way. The only thing is incomprehensible here is there are colleagues who swim against the tide, who negate members of the ITAA or the ETAA. ETAA is the European Tattoo Artists Association, but who want to benefit from what others have done. Despite all generosity, clear boundaries should be drawn. And the other insight we have to this Amsterdam convention is from a letter that's now in the Body Piercing Archive that was written by Sailor Sid Diller, a tattooer from Florida, again, very, very famous gay man, body piercer and tattooer. He was on stage with Fakir at that end of Reno. And he wrote a letter back to Fakir from the Intercontinental Hotel in Amsterdam after having been at the Amsterdam convention. And he says, importantly here, let me read you the exact quote. He said, it's been a most interesting trip, even if the ITAA convention was a total disaster. As I'm sure you've heard reports of that fiasco by now, so no need to dwell on that at length. And I don't actually know exactly what went down, but there's clearly some bad blood. Needless to say, I now wonder what's going to happen to the organization, as it sadly needs someone to take over and set things straight again. Otherwise, I'm afraid this will be the death knell for the ITAA. Time will tell on this, but I've never seen anything so totally fucked up in my life. It was a nothing convention of a nothing organization. I felt sorry for those who'd come great distances and great expense, such as Aussies and New Zealanders, and for an hour and a quarter of nothing but presentation of some trophies and crap, it was a complete waste of time. I was traveling with Elizabeth Weinsel, Jim Ward, and Doug Malloy, so we had lots of folks to look up and meet and other things to do. So as for myself, I could have cared less about the actual convention itself. There were some picture-taking sessions, and that was a help. There were some good people, and he was tattooed by Tattoo Sammy. But and he also met up with Uncle Alan, and Uncle Alan was... Not Uncle Alan. Alan Oversby, Mr. Sebastian. He was there too. But yeah, it was absolutely, absolutely kind of, absurd. So plaques were given to Elizabeth Weinsel, Kazuo Oguri in absentia, Terry Wrigley. Another award was given to Terry Wrigley, as well for organizing the convention. It started at, 12:35 and ended at 1:30. So it was only like an It was an hour long. Yeah, it was an hour long thing of basically people giving awards to the people that organized the convention.
Yeah, so how Sammy feels, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, and, you know, following this, you know, as I said, piercings weren't banned there, but they were, you know, there was, for certainly through the 80s, there was a real distinct separation between body piercing and tattooing. And this was the reason, right? It was this kind of fallout about whether Fakir Muzaffar or Ed Hardy was going to kind of be the face of tattooing during that decade. But, you know, it did, as I said a minute ago, it did excite, that convention excited Ed so much that he went to LA, he ended up buying Tattoo Land a few years later. He, you know, it was absolutely pivotal in his artistic development. It spurred him to publish Tattoo Time, which came out in 1982. You know, it was a real, like, Ed, there's a whole chapter in Ed's book, Where Your Dreams, about how exciting him and Malone found Reno. He describes even, like, them decided to wear, like, you know, they both wore Hawaiian shirts, and Ed had his famous green like poker visor that you've maybe seen photos of him wearing. And he did that because he knew that there was going to be press there. He wanted attention, very, very savvy. But that's when it all changes. And I think, just to finish the thought on this, and then we'll move on to Ed's convention. I think, you know, as we talked about with Paul, the tattoo industry in the 60s, the Western tattoo industry, you know, Germany, London, and basically San Francisco and LA, and New York, like, that's basically what we're talking about, with, you know, Chicago a bit as well, and some, you know, obviously some other exceptions, Denmark, there are people involved, but like the real centers, the scene and the industry is small enough that everyone, the weirdos, the piercers, the freaks, the quote unquote modern primitives, the S&M people, the old school guys like Sailor Jerry, and Les Goose, like, and people that fit into all of those categories and several and none, the industry is small enough to constrain them. By the time in the same group, by the time we get to Reno, the industry can no longer bear the weight of having the weird identity people, the people who are tattooed as an identity and the people who are tattooed as an art form, in the same grouping. Like, that's the schism. And I think even postmodern primitives, and I've written about this already, you know, a long time ago, and the new book goes into it as well, that is never repaired. That schism, I think, although there's a truce, I think exists to the present day. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Like, I think it is, and I think it's very unfair to the piercers as well. Like, I feel like in general, piercers are kind of like looked down upon as like a little bit of a lower form of art, which is ironic considering the general perception of tattooing by your average person. But yeah, no, I think it's unfortunate. Let's bring the two communities together. Unity.
Yeah.
We'll all unite against the barbers.
Of course, you know, all of this drama and the kind of fading and schisming of the ITAA in 79 leaves a bit of a gap. And that gap, of course, is going to be filled by Ed Hardy. It's the first convention held in 1982 on the West Coast. And again, it's this absolutely phenomenally important moment. It's held, interestingly, on a convention center that's in a converted steam cruiser called the Queen Mary. It was put together by Ed Hardy, along with two other collaborators, Ed Nolte and Ed Carraff. And you had working there basically like all of Ed's crew, right? Like Mike Malone, Cliff Raven, Bob Roberts, Jack Rudy, Pinky Yun, Don Nolan. It's in the aftermath of Sailor Jerry having passed away. And so, you know, and it's the year that that Ed's publishing Tattoo Time for the first time. And it's actually the first convention, in fact, the first time ever, that Lal Hardy goes to the United States, because he goes to the Queen Mary Convention and describes very lyrically how that convention changed his sense of what tattooing was like, could be like. Yeah, and again, like there's great photos there. Greg Irons, in fact, did one of the posters for it, which is like, you know, freaking amazing. Quote, attend the first expo of its kind in the world. Join artists from around the world and see tattooing performed on board. View contemporary, historic, and international exhibits. Buy beautiful books, art prints, t-shirts, and more. Enjoy the unique ambience of the Queen Mary, and history surrounds you as you dine amid the splendor of the Queen's famous three restaurants. Right? So that, I think, more than this like hour and a half in Amsterdam or the sort of slightly self-congratulatory things in the previous couple of years, like November 12th, 13th, 14th, 3 days in 1982, that feels to me like the description of a modern tattoo convention, right? Like, you know, where you can buy t-shirts, you can buy, and the t-shirts for it were freaking cool as well. It's a, you know, incredible lineup of artists, and it's a modern convention. And I think, you know, I think it's funny in a way, right? Because it, you know, that does sound like the kind of convention that Tattoo Sammy was asking for, something that sort of sold tattooing as an art form, that celebrated it, that tried to persuade at least members of the public that tattooing was amazing, although again a bit strange. So Lau visited, that became, you know, really important. It would cement the invitation for Lau to include stuff in Tattoo Time later on. And yeah, like, I don't know, if I have limited like tattoo time machine moments, but like 1982 Queen Mary Convention, I think would be a cool place to be, right? We've got all of these amazing people there at the same time. And I think, again, you know, after this, the floodgates are open. I think we can probably take as well Lau's engagement with that amazing convention at the Queen Mary and his, you know, friendship with Ed as the inspiration for his own convention, which was really important for British tattooing, held in Dunstable of all places, right? Which is a sort of small town in the southern Midlands near Luton. Queensway Hall, an American style convention, really the first, you know, the big American style convention. And again, listen to this, like the people that attended these events: Jack Rudy, Paul Booth, Bernie Luther, Horiyoshi the Third in tattooing in Dunstable. Ed Hardy was there, I think, 1 year. I mean, amazing. And like, yeah, it's an interesting venue. The venue's not there anymore, but it was a hall that had held gigs like David Bowie had played there and the Jam and the Sex Pistols and stuff. But yeah, there are photos from Dunstable of like Jack Yount, who we talked about with Sean Porter, having a pint with Mr. Sebastian. So, you know, the weirdos and the perverts were allowed at Dunstable in a way that probably, you know, wasn't, again, we're talking 87, so a few years later on. There's loads of great photos. Lau's put quite a few up on his Instagram. There's a photo of there of a guy walking around in his underpants pushing a shopping trolley with no tattoos, but apparently would go to every single one. Like,
yeah, he's supporting local business.
Yeah. You know, it was a place, I think, where that kind of, you know, American razzle dazzle stuff combined with like the very kind of particular scene in the UK that had been kind of birthed in a way by connection with America, right? Like both Lau and Alex Binney and people like Ron Akers and Ian of Reading and Dennis Cockle had all, you know, been engaged with what was happening in the US. And the, you know, the British versions allowing it to become weird again. There are great photos again at the convention with Sebastian and his clients with massive nipple piercings. And yeah, I think I never got to go actually, because just as I started getting tattooed, you know, when I was living abroad, it had finished. It just finished by the time I was old enough to attend, basically, right? Very, very sad. But it became, I think, sort of sadly missed. People do, you know, people do really sort of wax lyrically about Dunstable. But it, yeah, again, it sort of set the stage for what became the modern industry in Britain. Yeah, so I don't know, maybe that's a good place. That's a good place to finish. I don't know, like tattoo conventions then or tattoo conventions now.
Ooh, I don't know. I think they both offer different things. Like, I think tattoo conventions then, I think we will view them with very rose-tinted glasses. I'm sure there's probably loads of things that were like super annoying and inconvenient. And I think as people interested in history, tattoo conventions then are probably the choice. But I think, you know, for people who are like interested in art, it's like it's both. Because now there's so many people doing so many interesting things, and it's like the horizon is so much further away in terms of what's possible.
Well, the first London convention that Mickey Valletto ran at Truman Brewery was in 2004. So I attended that. I'd gone to a convention in, I think we mentioned last time, I've gone to a tattoo convention in France in 2001. But the first London convention starts 5 years after the Dunstable ends. But that does feel, I mean, again, we talked about it when we talked about the Tattoo the Earth tour, like pre and post 2000 feels like such a different time, because this is the period, like, you know, 70s and 80s is a time when the modern tattoo world is being made. And by the time 2000 comes around, it exists. I mean, it exists in a kind of form that's different from today. But it, you know, the first London convention, amazing as it was, felt polished. It felt, you know, it was exciting. It was super great. But, you know, you look back at these photos of Dunstable or Queen Mary, and it's much more raw. It's much less self-conscious.
I think it really depends, you know, much like the divide between the tattooers and the piercers, the freaks and the people who want to push stuff forward. It really depends on where you place the value is. And I think, you know, us being people interested in history, of course we're going to pick the, like, you know, Queen Mary's and the Renos and like the Amsterdams to some extent, and like we're going to want to be there where it all happened. But I think it's important to recognize that, you know, conventions right now are what's happening for, you know, people who are into tattooing now. Like, every convention is someone's first convention.
Maybe we should leave Sammy's final thought as a closing then, right? So if someone says that piercing is giving tattooing a bad name, I can tell him as an eyewitness and from talking with the manager of the hotel in Amsterdam, it was much more the tattoo artists and fans at Amsterdam who shocked the hotel guests to death by lowering their pants in the hotel lobby to show other interested ones their tattooed penises and scrotums. That was one of the reasons the convention was banned from the hotel. Right, so it finished at 1:30 because tattooers are walking around with their dicks out. Here it should be said, if we want to be respected in future, we must behave and respect the common regulations of the guest-giving hotel. This should include dress and manners as well to a certain point. When conventions become just an excuse to get boozed up in the company of others, we are really at the end of the line and should give up forever, right? So I think that's a good sentiment, right? And like the tattooers blame the piercers. He blames the tattooers. But ultimately, you know, if we want conventions to be good, they have to be celebratory of tattooing. And I think the best conventions, you know, Brighton that we were at the other day, Mickey's conventions across Europe, Tintin's in Paris, that the conventions that Total Tattoo are putting on in the UK at the moment, and plenty across the US as well. And the others from history are exactly that. They're celebrations of tattooing first and foremost, not just opportunities for people to get pissed and hang out together, although that is important as well.
Yeah. And with that in mind, this brings us to the end of the episode. And as always, we have to thank you, the listener, for listening to the show. But also that we have a Patreon if you enjoyed the episode and you want to hear more like it and episodes like this early. at present. By the, if you're listening to this on the free feed, this was up on the Patreon 2 weeks ago. So you can get episodes like that this early. You can get access to our new video series, Matt's History Corner, where Matt shows you knickknacks and ephemera from his collection. And you get to get bonus episodes as well. But with the £10 and above tier, you also get a shout out. And coming soon, £10 and above patrons will be getting a copy of the Gamages poster that we printed for Brighton. Keep an eye on your inboxes. But without further ado, thank you to Stephen McCann, Roy Hoxema, Morpheus Ravenna, Chris Block, Charlie Lightning, Bob of Extra, Shit Jesus, Sebastian Lewis, Reed Forden, Lupe Calderon, Guernica, Kirsten Wright, Kathy Burkhardt, James Schick, and Dylan. And it, as always, check us out on Instagram, it's Beneath Skin Pod. And if you want to get some cool t-shirts, posters, a signed copy of Matt's book, Paint People, check out our shop at beneaththeskinshop.com. Links for everything are down below. And it's a goodbye from me.
Bye.